Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When President-elect Joe Biden served in the Senate, he was known for reaching across the aisle to broker deals. In his victory speech Saturday, he called on his former congressional colleagues to meet him halfway.
Refusal of Democrats and Republicans to cooperate with one another. It's not some mysterious force beyond our control. It's a decision, a choice we make. And if we can decide not to cooperate, then we can decide to cooperate. And I believe that this is part of the mandate given to us from the American people. They want us to cooperate in their interest. And that's the choice I'll make.
So, yeah, Congress has been in gridlock, and the GOP Congressional Caucus isn't like the old days. Washington Post reporter Chelsea Janes has been covering the 2020 election. Welcome to the show, Chelsea.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You know, a lot of people keep talking about Joe Biden's conciliatory nature. Maybe that's makes him sound like a lightweight, and I don't intend that. But he is known for reaching across the aisle, as I said. But he's got a different Senate. He's got a whole different Congress than he had when he left, right?
He does. And he also has a different party. And I think that the idea of working with Republicans is no longer considered admirable to some people in his party. I think there are younger generations who say they didn't play by the rules. You know, they perpetrated a lot of harm on people from our point of view. Why would we suddenly, you know, reward them mm-hmm. by acting like they're good faith actors? And I think that that pushback against the notion of cooperating in good faith might be something that he has to deal with and potentially sort of, you know, mollify somehow.
President-elect Biden is pushing ahead with the transition. He's named a new coronavirus task force. I'm sure they've been working for months on all these plans because that's what he does. But how will resistance from the Trump administration affect all of this for the next few months?
You know, it could certainly get in the way. You know, I think now President-elect Biden and, you know, he's been working on trying to bring together some sort of helpful task force. They announced the actual names today. You know, so much of his campaign down the stretch was based on getting the coronavirus under control. Mm-hmm. And so I think that will be the priority. But, you know, part of that is having your people in the right position, is being able to get access to the information that, you know, a transitioning president would normally get access to. And a lot of that can't start until, you know, the results are accepted and, you know, the President Trump concedes. So I think that it could get in their way. I do think that Joe Biden and his staff are well versed enough in the machinations of you know, the government at that level that they can sort of prepare for what they'll be getting. But I do think they could be shut out of some helpful sort of infrastructure that, you know, would really help them along as they get ready to take office.
Yeah, the President Trump saying that the race is far from over. He's mounting multiple legal challenges in a number of states. And they're saying that they can't open up the, you know, the vault until when the electors vote in December or what, or when he gives up finally?
Yeah, I think that's an ongoing question. You know, when would the Trump administration, you know, Secretary of State Pompeo, for example, when would these people say, okay, we will make sure that you have the information you need. We will let you reach out to, you know, foreign leaders and start that conversation. Like, when can that happen? And I think certainly, you know, while there are legal challenges outstanding, Trump allies can say, we got to wait till this finishes. But from what we've heard from some of them, these challenges are not going to end soon. They're going to throw things at the wall and they're going to keep trying. Mm-hmm. So it is really interesting. And I think you'd really have to get a lot more people next to the president urging him to concede before he does that. And then maybe if that happens, you know, that transition can start to happen. But as things stand now, his team seems likely to continue to throw lawsuits at the wall, continue to try to pick up votes where they can, and continue to sort of sow the idea that even if Trump is on his way out, it wasn't under legitimate circumstances.
I thought it was interesting that he named, or whomever, named a non-lawyer to head the legal team in all of this.
Yes, definitely. You know, I think that's sort of in keeping with what we've seen. It's not necessarily the best and brightest that he's throwing at this cause. You know, I think during Bush versus Gore, from what I've read, you know, the organization was such that the Republicans really mounted a coherent sort of argument about what needed to happen there. And in this case, it's been largely incoherent. It's been, you know, disparate arguments from disparate people who don't necessarily have, you know, the respectability that they might need in the legal community to make these things stick. So, you know, it's sort of unsurprising that that's the case, but I think it's a testament to the fact that this is more of a PR experiment than it is a legal one. And we've seen that, you know, continue to play out.
Fundraising appeals for Trump's legal defense have already started. Who is paying for all these lawsuits?
That is a great question, and one I think we'll have more understanding of in the next few weeks. You know, I wish I sort of had the clarity of that, but I think it's, it is an ongoing question, and it should be, you know, the campaign. I think, you know, the Biden team also fundraised for a fight fund, as they called it, to sort of prepare for any legal challenges. You can do that. You can raise for that legal transition, you know, that interim period. But we really don't know where the Trump fundraising is going or where it's intended to go. So there's a chance they're just doing it the same way the Biden team is, but, you know, they have not held to norms in the past. So I think that'll be something everyone will have to watch for, is like, who is actually going to be paying for these things, much like, you know, who is paying for some of these events that they're holding on, you know, federal property down the stretch of the campaign.
Right, right. Exactly. Former President George W. Bush was, so far, as the highest profile Republican to congratulate the president-elect on his victory and defend, and also in his declaration, defend the integrity of the election, but say the votes still need to, you know, they still need to count the votes. Most others have not followed suit. I mean, you know, the Ohio governor hasn't said anything. It seems like there's more international interest in doing that than there is domestic.
Yeah, you know, I think that's right. I think right now, everyone is still sort of trying to feel out where things go from here when it comes to President Trump. You know, there's still people, I think, who believe it is in their electoral interest to stand by him, to sort of back the narrative that he's saying. And then I think there are people who, you know, think it's in their interest to come out and stand against that and stand for legitimacy and hope that in 2024, voters remember that they did that. But it seems that there's a whole nother group that's sort of caught in between, that's saying, if there's evidence, you know, let's look at that evidence. But of course, there is none. So I think we see a lot of Republicans currently sort of hedging their bets, trying to see where the dust is going to settle. But it certainly hasn't been a, you know, majority rebuke in any way, which I think is telling of the influence that Trump may continue to hold, you know, over that party and politics in the months and years to come.
Exactly. It sort of, it to a much greater degree, reminds me of kind of the Sarah Palin effect.
Yes, I think that's right. It's just interesting. And you can tell who, you know, people like Ben Sass and others who believe that the best idea is going to be to sort of break completely with President Trump and his rhetoric. And it's, I think, surprising to some that there are not more of those people.
Joe Biden is ahead in Arizona, counting still underway. And in Georgia, there's going to be a recount. There are about 10,000. He's up by about 10,000 votes. North Carolina and Alaska remain undeclared, but obviously he's comfortably ahead in Alaska for sure. North Carolina, it was closer, but why not call those? I mean, what do we know right now about why nobody's calling those at this point?
No, my understanding, and I don't know that it's complete, about North Carolina, is that there were some irregularities at one point that had to sort of just be checked out. I think my understanding is a lot of this is ballots where people, you know, filed provisional ballots where, you know, they have to make sure that they didn't, you know, somehow vote twice, that everything was actually invalidated. So that's something that I understand is sort of going on in both places. But I think in Arizona that the margin is just so slim that they're loath to sort of project anything they don't know. And even though there aren't a ton of votes left out, you know, after the weekend of counting, there are apparently enough that they're concerned that something might change. And I think that is partially just a product of the fact that the margin's really slim. And also partially due to the fact that Fox and the AP jumped out so early to call Arizona that the other networks sort of want to make sure they get it right. You know, they don't want everybody overturning this call if things go wrong. So I think that might be part of it, too.
Some nail biting at Fox and AP?
It seems that way from the outside, certainly.
It's interesting, though. Do you agree that the new center of the political universe will become Georgia now?
Yeah, it's really unbelievable how things have funneled into that state, you know, really over a 3-year period, you know, beginning with the work of Stacey Abrams and now, you know, obviously the two Senate races, the runoffs there that will determine control of the Senate effectively. And it's really fascinating. You know, it's a state that's changed a lot. I know people were, you know, sort of surprised when Senator Harris, you know, went down there for the Democrats. Obama was there in the last few days of the election, and the conversation then was, you know, wow, really, the state might flip. And I think the conversation now is, you know, the state is everything. And you know, whether those two candidates can sort of make up whatever deficits they faced in the general election and in the runoff is really going to be, you know, subject to turnout. And I think that they're very aware that the demographics in Georgia are now shifted to a point that the Democrats can expect to win there, but that they have to generate the kind of turnout they did in the general election and sort of just try to keep that energy going through these runoffs.
We've talked a lot about, you know, in recent days, a lot about ground games. And really what Stacey Abrams has done in Georgia is stunning by any measure.
It really is. I mean, I talked to a few people over the last week to say, you know, for all the people that sort of paved the way for a Black woman to rise to the vice presidency, Stacey Abrams, you know, was so close to being, you know, the first Black female governor of that state and was so close and showed what has to be done to sort of overcome the systemic and historic barriers that exist and put yourself in that position and that she really paved the way. And, you know, I think it's also an interesting question of what could happen in some states that we think are traditionally Republican. Should that kind of organizing take place? You know, should that kind of turnout be generated? Because it seemed, you know, that recently Georgia was really not an option for Democrats.
And, right.
You know, it's not that obviously the demographics have shifted, but that's true in many places. That's true in Texas. That's true in Arizona. And you sort of wonder what a Stacey Abrams like force in those places could sort of create in the next 4 years.
Right. North Carolina, Texas, Arizona. Absolutely.
Yep.
She went, you know, precinct by precinct almost and got out the vote. It was a machine. So what are you looking ahead to at this point? I mean, are we in a state of limbo and we're just going to keep seeing, you know, analyses of of this and that, but no real movement right now?
You know, I think that's part of it. I think, you know, the Trump team is going to throw legal things out there until President Trump says that he thinks he should concede. And we don't know when that'll be, if it'll be. So I do think that, you know, we're in limbo until those options get exhausted. But it does seem like day by day, more and more people are sort of coming around to the idea that this is legitimate, that there just isn't evidence to support his claims. And so perhaps that sort of trickled out. I know some of my colleagues have heard, you know, that people close to him are sort of getting that feeling, too. But I also think the Biden team is going to press on as if everything is normal and this is a normal transition and, you know, try to cement that from that perspective.
I wonder if the president can be mollified by the fact that he has so much power in the Republican Party right now.
Yeah, it is kind of hard to say. You know, it's like, it's just really an interesting balance. And you wonder when people will feel they need to jump ship and when they won't. But I think one thing we've also heard over the last few weeks is just the extent to which so many people in the Republican Party and at large sort of believe that Trump will continue to loom in one way or another because, you know, whatever you think of him, he showed them sort of an interesting new path to victory. And I think there are some people who think that a lot of what he did is something that can be used moving forward.
Well, Chelsea Janes, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Chelsea Janes, Washington Post reporter covering the 2020 election. Moving forward, we're going to hear from reporters again from Pennsylvania and Georgia. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Even before Pennsylvania was called for Joe Biden Saturday morning, President Trump had asked the U.S. Supreme Court to intervene and stop the count. The count continued, but so too will Trump's legal challenges. Herb Asher is political scientist and professor emeritus at Ohio State. Welcome back, Herb.
Good to be with you.
Also, Ned Foley, professor of election and constitutional law at Ohio State. Ned Foley, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Ann.
And John Micek, editor-in-chief of the Penn Capital Star, a nonpartisan, nonprofit news site, covers state government and politics in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. John Micek, welcome back.
Hi, good morning, Ann. Thanks for having me.
Biden has a 40,000-plus vote lead there outside the margin needed for an automatic recount. Pennsylvania officials could force one if they believe there are sufficient irregularities, right? What do you think about that? What's your prediction?
An automatic recount gets triggered at 0.5 percentage point under state law, or candidates and voters could ask for one. We have seen the Trump campaign pushing for automatic recounts in other states. We have not heard tell of that yet in Pennsylvania. But hey, it's only 25 after 11 on Monday, so you know anything could happen.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like I have to do that qualifier before every political show. How do voters ask for a recount in Pennsylvania? How does that work?
So you can voters in counties can petition to the Secretary of State's office. That is the office that oversees elections in the Commonwealth. And certainly we had Trump voters rallying, about 1,000 or more, rallying at the state capitol in Harrisburg on Saturday afternoon. I have to keep the days straight in my head now, but it's on Saturday afternoon. Mostly maskless, a lot of bellowing about not wanting to accept the results. A couple of state lawmakers said they were coordinating with the Trump campaign and with the RNC on the result here. So we will have to see what happens on that.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That is John Micek, editor-in-chief of the Penn Capital Star. It's a nonpartisan, nonprofit news site that covers state government and politics in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Ned Foley, what do you think is the end game here for the Trump camp?
That's a good question. I don't think any of this litigation strategy is going to work in court, and I don't think the recounts are going to change the result.
Uh-huh.
So it seems to be a PR strategy more than a traditional, you know, lawyerly litigation strategy. So, you know, is this an effort to really try to undo President-elect Biden's victory, or is this, you know, posturing for some other purpose? It's hard to tell at this point.
And what do you think, Herb Asher?
Well, I'd want to ask Ned, is it possible? First of all, I agree with him. There's no evidence of fraud. We're not going to overturn the vote. But is there any possible strategy here, Ned, that would try to delay the outcome of an election in a number of states so that the electoral vote, in a sense, can't be certified? And therefore, in fact, there are fewer electoral votes to be counted such that no candidate will have a majority when that date comes. Or even going further, is there a possibility that if you have a lot of uncertainty and a lot of delays, that a state legislature can step in and designate a slate of electors different from the slate committed to the candidate who carried the state?
Yeah, well, taking those two things in turn, I had been worried about the delay issue before, you know, November 3rd election day. I'm much less worried about that now. It seems to me in all these states, we're going to get a certified popular vote tally in time for the electors to meet, which is on Monday, December 14. You know, so I don't see litigation really derailing that process. On the whether the state legislatures attempt to come in and have a rival slate of electors that are appointed by legislatures, that's something that I have been concerned about. It's a theoretical risk that's out there. The good news, and John may want to speak to this, in Pennsylvania, for example, legislative leaders have really swatted down that idea and said they're not going to do that. So as a practical reality, it seems to me there's very, very low risk that that will actually materialize. But that may be the strategy here. The way in which delay might be what the Trump team is after is enough delay in the finality of the official certification, not to prevent electors from meeting, but to get the social media space and the, you know, the talk radio space or what have you the base to come out to try to put pressure on state legislatures. Whether that can happen politically or not, I leave to you political experts on whether that's feasible at all.
What do you think, John Micek?
So, you know, that was based on that Atlantic story that kind of blew everything up in, September, October, about lawmakers stepping in to replace the slate of electors. Jake Corman, who is the top second-ranking Republican party in the Pennsylvania State Senate, did quite emphatically smack that down and said that they wanted to respect the will of the voters. Just to be sure on that, though, House Democrats went to their legal team to get a legal opinion. And according to the opinion that I have in front of me, the only way they could also change the slate of electors is by changing Pennsylvania election code, which would then sort of be open to all sorts of amendment mischief. So that may not be a road that they want to go down. Lawmakers are coming in for a very rare lame duck session where they have to finish up the second half of the state budget. So they have quite enough on their hands. And because that's just such a political fireball, it seems unlikely that they would want to crack the hood on the election code while they're in there as well.
Wait a minute. Lame ducks are rare in Pennsylvania?
Yep. We haven't had one in 10 years. I think.
Wow.
Yeah. I know. We actually did something.
It's like
right.
A morass here.
Yeah, I mean, for a long time, I've been covering Pennsylvania politics for about 20 years, and probably for the first decade and some change of that, there's always a lame duck session where all kinds of mischief transpired. When Joe Scarnati, the new Senate President pro temp, came in 06, he smacked that down and said they didn't want to do lame duck sessions anymore.
Wow.
And by and large, we have not had one. Pennsylvania passed a bifurcated budget this year that provided funding for the first 5 months of the fiscal year. Now they have to come back in, except for education, and now they have to come back in and finish that work. So you're actually going to have some defeated lawmakers voting on a budget without accountability, which is not an ideal situation, but that's where the state is right now.
And that's because of the pandemic.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. John, the state is separating ballots that came in after November 3rd because of the Trump campaign is challenging those. Pennsylvania Republicans asked the U.S. Supreme Court to intervene, and Justice Samuel Alito instructed the 67 counties to comply. What are we talking about here? How many? Is it enough to make a difference?
Yeah, I mean, the counties were doing that anyway. It's probably important to point out. So Kathy Buchvar, the Secretary of State, had instructed counties a couple of weeks ago, to segregate those ballots. So that was more sort of an affirmation by Alito of something the counties were already doing. So what happened was, because of the pandemic, Buchvar's office gave counties the leeway to count ballots that were postmarked by Election Day that arrived by 5 p.m. Just this last Friday.
Mm-hmm.
The legislature kicked up a fuss about that, claiming that only they had the power to set the time, place, manner of elections, and that it could not be done by executive fiat. Buchvar was backed up by the state Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court declined to take up the matter before the election. Then we had this sort of procedural thing by Alito just the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that big of a universe, as I understand, of ballots. I can't put a specific number to it, probably in the low thousands. It's not a heck of a lot. You know, the counties are now counting provisional ballots and military ballots, and there's a whole lot more of those, 100,000 plus or minus of provisional and mail-ins, but not a whole lot of those kind of late-arriving ballots that everybody's been making such a fuss about. The conventional wisdom also is that the Supremes, as conservative as that court is, may not want to upend the will of voters who acted in good faith, who played by the rules they were handed, irrespective of whatever political squabbling is going on above their heads.
But, Ned Foley, the Supreme Court certainly has the power to do that, does it not?
Oh, if they wanted to, sure. They could absolutely step in and throw out those ballots.
Uh-huh.
But, again, from the conversations I've had, the indications to the court might be loath to do that, again, because that would punish voters who acted in good faith and played by the rules that they were handed.
Hmm.
Yeah, my sense, like John, I think there's maybe a split among the conservatives on the Supreme Court on that. point, I think that Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh are likely to join with the liberals to protect innocent voters in the way that John suggests. I think you might get some of the more conservative justices, like a Justice Thomas, for example, being willing to invalidate those ballots. The best signal for this is a case out of South Carolina that happened in the skirmishing. You know, I can't remember whether it was September or thereabouts, but it wasn't exactly the same issue. But Kavanaugh and Roberts refused to hurt the voters just when they were acting innocently as the courts were fighting over the different rules. So that's the strongest signal that we've got so far that it's unlikely that the U.S. Supreme Court as a whole would invalidate any of these ballots.
I'll let the other Jeff go first. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, Herb?
I'll say, and the number of such ballots that we're talking about is small. I don't have the exact number, but in no way could it affect the outcome of the election.
Okay.
Right. And then the other point to make, if I might, Anne, is that even if you, Pennsylvania is a state to focus on, but given where the Electoral College math is right now and the number of states in which President-elect Biden is ahead, you know, the Trump campaign would have to somehow undo not just Pennsylvania, but as I understand it, you know, three states would have to be undone. You know, whether we're talking Arizona or Georgia or Wisconsin or Pennsylvania, this can't be a single state strategy like Florida in 2000. This would have to be a multi-state undoing of the apparent results. You know, so that's just a much bigger issue. And in that respect, 1960 might be a useful comparison because, you know, some people were urging Richard Nixon to try to challenge, you know, Illinois because of allegations about Mayor Daley in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And whatever one thought about that, it wouldn't have made any difference because flipping Illinois wasn't enough. Nixon would have had to flip both Illinois and Texas. And it just was perceived as too heavy a lift to try to undo two states. And so Nixon didn't attempt to do that. Here, Trump would have to undo three states for this kind of strategy to actually prevail. And then last point on this, ultimately this will come down to the what happens in the United States Congress when it officially confirms the Electoral College results in a meeting on January 6th. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, ultimately the senators as well as the members of the House, but the Republicans in the Senate will have to, you know, go on record in essence affirming President-elect Biden's victory.
Herb Asher, and then I want to get your thoughts on this too, John Misek. Michigan, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Illinois went for Biden. Ohio gave Trump the same 8-point margin of victory that he achieved in 2016. How are Ohio voters different from these other Great Lakes states?
Well, first thing to point out is that if you look at past elections, Democrats always run less well in Ohio than in those states. Even if a Democrat can carry Ohio, that Democrat carries Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota by a larger margin. So relatively speaking, Ohio is more Republican than those states. But to your more direct question about this year, what's going on in Ohio? We've actually seen in Ohio movements by voters or groups of voters, some in a pro-democratic direction, such as some of the suburban areas. Delaware County became less Republican again this year. But you're also seeing Western Ohio, which is really, part of Indiana and Kentucky. You're seeing margins there. If the Democrats used to lose by 65-35, they're losing there by 80-20. There are counties where the Republicans got over 80% of the vote. Uh-huh. Southeastern Ohio, which used to be more competitive, actually have Democratic strength there. That's where Ted Strickland was from. That's become more Republican. Mm-hmm. And this year, partly for economic reasons, Eastern Ohio is now flipped over pretty much to the Trump campaign, or to the Republicans. And I should say, maybe it was actually the Donald Trump. maybe the next Republican candidate would not be as Mahoning and Trumbull or whatever.
Yeah.
Because Donald Trump did capture a certain working class populism, in some ways, a little similar to, although in a very different style, that Sherrod Brown has been successful with. So what we're seeing in Ohio, the major counties have been, especially in Franklin County and Hamilton, have really been moving in the Democratic direction. Some of the prosperous suburbs have moved in a Democratic direction, but the rest of the state has moved in a Republican direction. And then people will start asking, well, what about the state of the Democratic Party in Ohio versus Virginia, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan? And I think the answer is that the Democratic Party as an entity, as an organization, is not a very strong party, and it's almost non-existent in parts of the state.
John Micek, you know, just the trajectory for Pennsylvania, that much different?
Well, I mean, I can't speak to the situation on the ground in Ohio, obviously, but, you know, the one thing that is interesting is that Biden was able to reassemble the blue wall in the upper Midwest, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, but was not able to reassemble the Obama coalition, which gave him Obama Ohio, and my friends can correct me if I'm wrong, in 8 and 12.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the kind of thing that was striking there. We've seen some of the same shifts in Pennsylvania that you folks have seen across the border in the West. The Philadelphia suburbs are markedly blue and probably never coming back to the Republican column after being sort of a haven for moderate Republicans for an awfully long time. Pittsburgh and Allegheny County is still markedly blue. But when you get into the Southwest, the Washington counties, Beaver County, hard along your eastern border, the blue dogs who used to be there are gone now. And those are pretty solidly red counties. You see that also in northeastern Pennsylvania, irrespective of Biden's win on his home turf in Scranton. Donald Trump recaptured Luzerne County, which he famously flipped in 2016, by a wider margin in 2020. Biden conversely flipped Northampton County and Erie County, two counties that Trump won in 2016, by 4 or 5 points, not a great margin. But it goes to the fact that Biden kind of, while he put together the big wins in Philadelphia and its suburbs and Allegheny County, Pittsburgh and its suburbs, the rest of his wins were kind of marginal. It was cleaving off 5% here, 5% there. And we know that he did eat into Trump's margins among white working class voters in Pennsylvania. He didn't win them all the way back.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, to paraphrase Everett Dirksen, 5% here, 5% there. Pretty soon you start talking real numbers.
Exactly.
You know, that was enough to get him over the goal line in Pennsylvania.
Right. Well, John Micek, I have to say goodbye to you. I really appreciate your time again. I hope you're trying to get some rest somewhere along the line here.
Sleep is for the weak.
Okay, John Micek, editor-in-chief of the Penn Capital Star. It's a nonpartisan, nonprofit news site that covers state government and politics in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Still with us, staying with us, Herb Asher, professor emeritus of political science at Ohio State, and Ned Foley. He's a professor of election and constitutional law at OSU. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the 2020 presidential election results and related issues. Still with us, political scientist Herb Asher, professor emeritus at Ohio State University, and Ned Foley, professor of election and constitutional law at OSU. Joining us is Georgia Public Broadcasting politics reporter Stephen Fowler. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Stephen, Joe Biden holds a little over, and of course, correct me if I'm wrong on all this, I've only checked about 10 minutes ago, holds a little over a 10,000 vote lead in Georgia. The Secretary of State there said Friday there will be a a recount. Was it triggered automatically, or can he order one? What's going on?
Right. So Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger mentioned that there would be a recount. It's a likely recount because of Georgia law that says a losing candidate, if they're within half a percentage point of their winning candidate, then they can request a recount. And so the Trump campaign has indicated that they are definitely going to ask for one if the time comes and they are indeed the loser.
Some absentee ballots were tossed Saturday over signature and other issues that couldn't be resolved. Not enough to make a difference, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's about 10,000 or so vote lead that Joe Biden has. There have been still some ballots trickling in. There's about a couple hundred that came in this morning from suburban Gwinnett County. And it's really not going to be enough to make a difference because we haven't heard very many recounts, switch results. And the ones that have, they were talking about results within the dozens of votes.
How will the presidential outcome in Georgia affect momentum going into this, and correct me if I'm wrong, unprecedented two runoffs for Senate in January?
So, you know, all eyes are on Georgia for the next 2 months. January 5th is going to be the runoff for both Senate races. And what we're seeing already is a national interest. Former presidential candidate Andrew Yang said that he was going to be moving to Georgia to help things for the next 2 months. Senator Marco Rubio is coming later this week to campaign for Republican Kelly Loeffler. So expect the nation's attention from the presidential race magnified just on this one state.
And two races which could change the balance in the U.S. Senate.
That's right. You know, there are two Senate races. Both of them are currently held by Republicans. Both of them, Democrats believe, could be flipped. And that could end up changing the balance of power and completely altering the landscape for Joe Biden's first year as president-elect and president.
You know, we hear a lot of credit being given to Stacey Abrams, gubernatorial candidate a few years ago, turned her loss into a, you know, mission to change the makeup of the electorate in Georgia. But has she come out and spoken much publicly? Because I haven't seen much.
She hasn't really said too much publicly. I talked to her just before Election Day,
uh-huh,
and asked her, you know, what she was thinking and feeling about the fact that she didn't win maybe enabled more Democrats to win, including Joe Biden to win. And, you know, she told me that it's long been about the work of registering more voters, of turning out a diverse coalition and making this really years-long change to have Georgia in the conversation as a state that as a battleground. And she says will eventually end up being a solidly blue state.
Herb Asher, what do you make of the Georgia story here and Stacey Abrams' role in it?
Well, it provides a model, perhaps, of some of the things that we need to be doing in Ohio, whether it's through the state Democratic Party or whether it's through some kind of organization that goes beyond the traditional labor leaders that have dominated the state Democratic Party.
Uh-huh.
The significance of Georgia in terms of these two elections coming up, if Biden had lost the state by some margin, I think a lot of people would have been saying, oh, it's going to be so difficult to win both of those Senate seats or one. But the very fact that Biden won the state, albeit by a narrow margin, makes it so much easier for Stacey Abrams, for the Democrats, to say to the Democrats in Georgia and also nationally, we are competitive. We have demonstrated this. Now let's focus on these Senate seats. And I think that really is partly morale. It's partly really getting, you know, if you think you have a new coalition in Georgia and that coalition is new black voters, new young voters or whatever, those aren't voters with a long-term pattern of voting. So you worry about drop-off in a non-presidential election. But having just won the presidency and this election coming up so soon, and it is so significant, as everybody's saying, maybe you in fact can maintain the levels of turnout that allowed Biden to win the state.
What do you think, Stephen Fowler, about that?
Yeah, I typically in these double-barrel Senate runoffs where you have both seats up at the same time, a party that wins one seat ends up ending them both, winning them both. And so that's the what's at stake here. The interesting thing about turnout is that Republicans have usually been favored in these runoffs in Georgia. But like you said, there's an energized coalition here and there's a lot at stake. The other thing that I'm interested in is figuring out how this works is January 5th is election day. Georgia has 3 weeks of early voting. The last day of early voting is New Year's Day, and so with early voting over the holidays, there's not going to be the same level of access to the polls as you would find in a general election, and there's not going to be the same level of interest. You know, people aren't going to go open up presents and then head to the polls on Christmas Day, and so this race will definitely be one that could be won or lost primarily based on absentee by mail voting. And what we've seen in Georgia with the data so far is that the reason that Joe Biden won was from absentee by mail ballot margin.
Okay. You said access to the polls. How do the polls operate in a special election? How do people early vote?
Well, Georgia does have a 3 week early voting period for in-person early voting, including one mandatory Saturday. And the mandatory Saturday this year is December 26th. And so counties set the number of polling places that they have for early voting sites. For example, Fulton County, which is where the city of Atlanta is, had 30 early voting locations staffed for the general election. But, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to find that same level of staffing and access during all 3 weeks of early voting in this runoff because of the holidays and because of government buildings being open or not open. But then there are absentee by mail ballots that people can request as soon as, you know, today for them to be mailed out mid-November. And there are a large number of Georgians, about 750,000, that will automatically receive one as part of a rollover list of voters over 65, military and overseas, or disabled. But Georgians can request those online. So I think this runoff, you'll see voting patterns be much, much different from what you might expect of seeing people line up on election day.
You know, Annette Foley, I'm trying to think about the legal obligation of the state to provide access, even if it's during holidays.
Yeah, well, I think the laws are going to be enforced, right? I mean, they may not be able to vote on Christmas Day, but I would think they would have to open the polls the next day. But as Steve's saying, are people going to show up and take advantage of it? What's turnout rates going to be? You know, as I was listening to this conversation, I couldn't help but think about the trade-off between a runoff like Georgia has versus this new concept of a runoff that people are hearing about called ranked choice voting, sometimes called instant runoff voting.
Something you've written a little bit about, yeah.
Yeah. Now, again, that can't be done for this year, but depending on how the Georgia experience goes this year, there may be more talk because an instant runoff would have allowed to basically hold a runoff on the same day as the regular election. So you'd have an answer already based on the November 3rd ballots as to who should win. On the other hand, voters wouldn't be allowed to process the new information, the fact that President-elect Biden seemed to be in the lead. So there's trade-offs there about which method of voting is the better one.
Yeah, by the way, Ned Foley's 2019 book is titled Presidential Elections and Majority Rule, The Rise, Demise, and Potential Restoration of the Jeffersonian Electoral College. So there's, are the odds makers calling anything yet in Georgia, Stephen Fowler?
Well, you know, the reason that we're getting to this runoff point is because the race was just a razor-thin margin both for president and the special Senate election. Mm-hmm. But, you know, election mapping, election Twitter types are saying that really they have one maybe slightly favoring a Democrat and one slightly favoring a Republican because of the dynamics of the race. Incumbent Senator David Perdue is running on his record in his first 6 years in the Senate, saying he's a businessman and that, you know, he'll continue to do things for the economy. But Kelly Loeffler, who was appointed to fill out the remainder of Johnny Isaacson's term, has been grappling with a lot of perception issues over her immense wealth and her ties to some stock trades that her husband made and that she made and the coronavirus pandemic. And so she is a little bit more vulnerable than David Perdue is in this account. And so that's why you see really, I mean, it's all going to come down to turnout. It's cliche, but it's true. But, you know, the interesting dynamic of this race is that for Democrats and Republicans, the strengths and weaknesses of each opponent and each candidate there can kind of build off of each other. So really, it is a two-person ticket rather than two individual Senate races.
John Ossoff, the Democrat, has challenged Republican and incumbent David Perdue to three debates. What's going on with that?
It is probably still too early to figure out how many debates, what we're going to have. They did participate in two debates for the general election. One was put on by the Atlanta Press Club. One was put on by a TV station down on the coast in Savannah. And the third was supposed to happen, but that got canceled because President Trump held one of his final campaign rallies 3 days before the election up in Northwest Georgia, and Perdue was there instead of the debate. But I think it would be hard-pressed with all of this attention for there not to be any debates for both of the races. So I know that we're still hearing some scheduling talks happening of figuring out when we can get those on the calendar.
You know, Herb Asher, we only have a couple of minutes left, but I am interested in your thoughts about Georgia and what this portends.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think first let me ask a question about the other race. I understood that in Georgia, in order for Kelly to have made the runoff to come in second, she moved far to the right because she was really still trying to get Republican votes and competing with Collins. Is that accurate? And then how easy a time does she have to perhaps then get back a little bit more to the center? And how does Ralph Warnock play? This is a, you know, African-American head of the Ebenezer Baptist, I mean, very prominent person. Is that race, do you think that race is competitive?
Right. So, you know, Kelly Loeffler put out ads during the general election saying she was more conservative than Attila the Hun. This is the same Kelly Loeffler that was appointed by Republican Governor Brian Kemp to be a moderating influence to appeal to suburban women that the GOP had lost in recent years. And so Attila the Hun does not exactly play well with conservative moderate women. So now that she has made it into this runoff, it will be interesting to see her to try to pivot back to the center. And because of that, and because most of her time was spent attacking Doug Collins, Raphael Warnock spent the last few months just introducing himself to the rest of the state and putting out positive campaign messages. And the first ad that he put out in the runoff earlier this week said that, you know, it was a kind of a lighthearted ad saying that they're going to put out negative things about me, like Raphael Warnock hates puppies and he eats pizza with a fork. And so the tone of that race is going to be completely different. And that's the one that odds makers, if they had to put money on, would say that he stands a better chance of beating her than John Ossoff does of David Perdue.
Yeah, very interesting.
Well, Stephen Fowler, thank you so much for your time. I hope we can call on you again because, as you said, it is the center of the political universe now while everything else is tied up in court. So thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Stephen Fowler, political reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting. Also, Herb Asher, professor emeritus of political science at Ohio State. Thanks as always, Herb. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Ned Foley, professor of election and constitutional law at Ohio State. Thanks for your time today, too. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you, Ann. Good to be with you again.
And that's it for now. So thanks for joining us. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.